From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, who owns information? We talk with law professor James Boyle about intellectual property rights and the legal and ethical challenges posed by the information age. Also, how children learn to speak. Linguist Naomi Barron tells us about the variety of ways in which children learn to crack the language code, why some talk sooner than others, and the role parents play in the process. And commentator Gerald Early discusses the new book, The Future of Race, by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Cornel West. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The Army says a U.S. soldier was wounded in a shooting today in northern Bosnia. Details are sketchy, but there's no indication the gunfire was hostile. The U.S. Army headquarters in Bosnia says only that the shooting took place in the area of operations of the U.S. 2nd Brigade of the 1st Armored Division. Officials won't give information about the soldier's condition. Meanwhile, Bosnian Federation police say they will cut road and phone links with the Serbian-held town of Trnovo near Sarajevo. This is in response to Serbian attacks Monday on Muslim refugees who tried to go home. Colin Soloway reports from Sarajevo.
IFOR and the UN Police Task Force condemn the Federation police move as a violation of Dayton's freedom of movement guarantees, but continue to blame the Bosnian Serb government for the crisis created by its violent opposition to refugee visits. Three Muslims were killed and at least six wounded by shrapnel and gunfire when they tried to visit their homes in the Serb-held town of Doboj in northern Bosnia Monday, and since then all crossings have been blocked. Wednesday afternoon, the Bosnian Serb refugee minister refused to sign a statement guaranteeing Muslim refugees' right to return. In a meeting with the international community's High Representative Carl Bildt, Serb Parliament Speaker Momcilo Krajnic reaffirmed these rights, but international officials are doubtful that Krajnic, one of the Serbs' chief architects of ethnic cleansing, will follow through on his promise. The American Special Coordinator on Bosnia returns to the Balkans on Sunday in hopes of resolving this latest crisis. For National Public Radio, this is Colin Soloway in Sarajevo.
The Commerce Department says the economy grew at a strong pace for the first quarter in 1996. NPR's John Itzty reports.
Despite the stormy winter weather and the temporary shutdown of the federal government, the U.S. economy grew at a 2.8% annual pace in the first quarter of the year. That's one percentage point above expectations. The strength came from robust consumer spending, which advanced almost three times faster than it did during the final 3 months of last year. The strong expansion was also fueled by healthy business investment. Both businesses and consumers spent a lot on computer products as that industry soared in the first quarter, accounting for more than one-fourth of overall growth during the period. Recent data suggests the growth spurt will continue. Yesterday, a report showed manufacturing expanded in April for the first time since early last summer. I'm John Itzty in Washington.
A published report suggests Ford Motor Company apparently missed thousands of minivans at risk for safety defects. USA Today reports Ford's recall of nearly a million cars and trucks in North America left out tens of thousands of vehicles. The paper says the missed vehicles could be more prone to fire than the ones that were recalled. The paper cites an internal Ford memo that says there are problems with the ignition switch. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has fallen nearly 18 points to 5,557. The Nasdaq is down 3.5 points at 1,196. This is NPR. Firefighters in New Mexico aren't declaring complete victory, but if the good weather holds, they may fully contain the Dome Fire. The blaze has spread nearly charred over 17,000 acres and had threatened the Los Alamos National Laboratory, where the first atomic bomb was built. There is nuclear material stored there. Meanwhile, California firefighters say they have almost completely contained an 11,000-acre wildfire, but the situation is not as good in Arizona. Wildfires there have charred about 45,000 acres. It's the state's biggest fire in a quarter century. Officials do say they're making progress. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat is to visit the United Nations today on the heels of yesterday's visit to the White House. President Clinton received the Palestinian leader with honors due a statesman. Linda Fasulo reports from New York.
PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat is scheduled to wrap up his trip to the U.S. with a stop at the U.N. There, he is expected to have a meeting and working lunch with Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, followed by a press conference. At the UN, Arafat is likely to press his case for more economic reconstruction aid and the lifting of travel restrictions imposed by Israel after a series of Hamas suicide bombings in February and March. He says the restrictions keep 120,000 Palestinians from their jobs. Also likely to be discussed are upcoming talks with Israel, in which Arafat is expected to push for Palestinian nationhood by the year 2000. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo in New York.
Legislation featuring new curbs on illegal immigration is expected to pass the Senate today. The bill nearly doubles the size of the Border Patrol, and it increases penalties for forging papers and smuggling in illegal aliens. Senate Minority Leader Tom Daschle says the bill will get plenty of support from both parties. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. We live in the age of information. For many people, this cliché means vague alarm at the glut of newspapers, talk shows, electronic data, and telemarketers, mixed with concerns about privacy and access, profanity, and censorship. James Boyle thinks we've got the information age all wrong. In a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times, he wrote, "To understand the age we've entered, we need to figure out how the world changes when information becomes one of the most important forms of wealth and power. When everything from the pattern of purchases revealed by credit card receipts to the pattern of your DNA can become a bite of information to be bought and sold in the marketplace." James Boyle is a professor of law at American University and the author of a new book about law and information called Shamans, Software, and Spleens. You could argue that information has always been a powerful commodity, and every age has had its information innovations. I asked Boyle, what's so different now?
The way we think, even, of information, I mean, when I, at least, was in science class, I learned about biology as being something to do with cells and flesh and frogs' eggs and fairly sort of distasteful things that were quite physical and slimy. Nowadays, we think of it as genetic information. We think of it as a code. We think of it as something to be manipulated, something to be edited, almost like a word processing document. And so it's not just the technology or the economy. It's our concepts that have actually changed so that now we think of the world as an information society, and so it becomes one.
Well, how would you say that information differs from other commodities?
I think there are lots of interesting qualities to information. For one thing, and Jefferson observed this, it's a gift which I can give you and apparently be none the poorer. I tell you Pythagoras' theorem or the way to build a column, and I'm no poorer, and yet you've been enriched. And we think of that as being unlike any other kind of good or service, where we actually think, if I give you a cup, then I don't have a cup anymore. On the other hand, that's actually one of the bad things about information, because what that means is that it's often expensive to generate, but very cheap to copy. I spent 5 years putting this book together, but it could be photocopied in minutes by someone else. Microsoft can spend 5 years putting together Windows 95, and yet anyone can copy it on a set of diskettes. And so intellectual property, the legal way that we protect information, becomes much more important, something that we need to protect if we want to encourage further innovation. At least that's the belief. That's, I think, one of the things that goes on in the information society. Another thing that happens is that if you say to people, do you think everyone should have health care or housing and so forth, then that sounds like socialism. But if you say, do you think everyone should have information, then that's something that even someone who believes in laissez-faire and the market is much more likely to agree with you on.
You write that we're in the middle of an information land grab. Why don't you tell us who the buyers are and what the territory is? Lay it out for us.
Well, one nice analogy might be to the history of the West in the United States. I think, going by the history I've read at least, that there was this idea that the West was infinite. It went on forever. And there was also the idea that the West needed to be developed. And so the idea was, well, let's give extremely large monopolies, for example, to the railroads, large tracts of land stretching across the whole country. And as a result, they'll develop this for us. And there was a sense that there's always going to be enough and as good left over, because this land goes on forever. Well, people sort of think the same thing, I think, about information and information products, about intellectual property.
And what do we have to fear from that?
Well, in my book, I argue that we're very good at worrying about censorship. If the government comes along and tells you, you may not broadcast this, then you're outraged and you have a very good network of people to turn to. You call the ACLU and they're right outside your door instantly, unless they're defending the KKK at that moment. You call Penn, you call other journalists. Everyone understands the issue. It's a free speech issue and everyone has a good set of responses and we're very good at responding to that. And that's what's happening right now with the coverage of the internet. It's about 90% of it seems to be about cyber smut and censorship of cyber smut. What people aren't really covering or what they're not really focusing on is the more subtle dangers posed by the ownership of information.
You mentioned the Human Genome Project and genetic engineering as all part of this information explosion. And I'd like to consider now the spleen mentioned in the title of your book. In 1976, John Moore was treated for leukemia at a hospital in California. His doctors realized that his particular form of the disease made his blood very valuable on the medical market. Why don't you tell us, take the story from there. What happened then?
Well, the luckless Mr. Moore had a very nasty kind of leukemia called hairy cell leukemia, and his doctors, who actually provided him excellent medical care, had to take out his spleen, a grossly enlarged spleen, in order to treat him. What they realized along the way, as you pointed out, is that they could develop a very valuable cell line from this, using, I suppose, recombinant DNA processes, and which they then did. Unfortunately, they didn't tell Mr. Moore any of this, and the cell line is apparently going to be worth some billions of dollars, indeed already is worth billions of dollars, and they didn't tell Mr. Moore, and they certainly didn't cut him in on the profits. And Mr. Moore said, well, this is my body, this is my spleen, but he also said, it's not just that it's my body, this is my genetic information. You got this basically from my DNA, from my genetic code. And he went to the California Supreme Court saying that he should be able to own this fundamental essence of what he was as a human being. And the California Supreme Court disagreed with him. They said that that really he didn't own his spleen. They gave a set of reasons, which I discuss in the book. But the thing that I find most interesting about it is that they actually at one point referred to him as a naturally occurring raw material. They seem to portray the doctors as kind of sort of inventive geniuses who, out of this naturally occurring raw material, were producing great works. It's sort of as if the marble was lobbying for a right in the statue that Michelangelo produces, saying, well, I contributed to this too. And the court, I think, partly lost in this kind of romantic haze, said, well, these scientists are artists, they actually used this term, and they deserve to own the genetic material. They also thought that if Mr. Moore got to control it, then no one would invent any new drugs. What I say in the book about all of this is, apart from the kind of bizarre sort of Frankenstein-like quality of the opinion, which really is quite absurd at times.
Well, the doctors essentially did harvest a spleen from a living human being.
They harvested a spleen from a living human being. Of course, from the court's point of view, Mr. Moore had abandoned it, just as if you had, you know, tossed your coffee cup into the trash so that he exerted no more property rights on it. He didn't want it, after all. It was a diseased spleen. He wanted rid of it. So they said, well, it's not yours anymore. But he also claimed that he should own his genetic information, and he used a wonderful set of cases to argue this. There's a legal doctrine called the right of publicity, which is how famous people such as yourself can control the commercial use of their image. Johnny Carson, for example, once sued a manufacturer of portable toilets. The poor man who made the portable toilets had called them "Here's Johnny Portaloos" or something like that,
and I'd sue him too.
Then had described himself as the world's foremost commodian. So Mr. Carson didn't like this, and he sued. And the court said, "Quite right, you get to control these images so strongly associated with you, Johnny Carson." Just like Bela Lugosi gets to own the image of fangs and cape and there are a variety of other examples. So Mr. Moore said, well, look, if Johnny Carson can own "Here's Johnny," which is a phrase that he doesn't even say, you know, Ed McMahon said, and if Bela Lugosi can own the image of fangs and cape, surely I can get to control my genetic information, my DNA code. And the court said, no, I'm sorry, that's totally different. That's You know, this is a fame that Mr. Carson has kind of participated in producing, whereas with you, you know, you just sat there and grew. You didn't do anything. And again, I think you get this image of the sort of the artistic creator counterposed against the kind of dull, lumpish brute who just sits waiting to be harvested. And I think that's one of the things that goes on in the minds of courts when they're thinking about intellectual property. They really have this kind of author and inventor focus that kind of blinds them both to some of the human elements. It does seem that the doctors didn't treat Mr. Moore terribly well, and indeed the court did give him some rights at the end of the story, but also blinds them to the social implications of what they're doing.
In a related example that you discuss, a researcher at the NIH on the Human Genome Project applied for a patent for a large number of partial DNA sequences, and he was denied the patent.
That's right.
Why was he denied? What are the implications of trying to patent genetic material?
In his case, Dr. Ventner had worked out an ingenious technique that allowed him to tell which portions of the human genetic code were functional, which ones actually, so to speak, did the work, and which ones were the so-called junk DNA, the kind of background noise, although I gather some scientists think that actually it may be more significant than just background noise. And so what he had was he had a list of these DNA sequences. He didn't know what they did, but he knew that they did something. And so he wanted to get rights over them. And it was rather as if someone's saying, well, look, I have here a set of compounds, a set of drugs. Now, I don't know whether this one is the one that stops you being sick, and this is the one that cures hemophilia, and this is the one that does something else, but I know they're all functional, and I want to patent them. And basically, the reason in sort of lay terms, the reason he was denied is that the patent office said, well, you don't actually know what these things are doing, so to what extent are you actually bringing forward something which actually sort of has a useful function? To what extent have you actually produced anything new? But human genes can be patented, and indeed Harvard has actually patented, well, indeed there are a number of patents on animals. Harvard has a patent on the so-called oncomouse, which is a mouse that actually has human genetic material engineered into it, which is a transgenic species, you know, something that has a little bit of a human being inside of it to make it more prone to get cancer.
Now, all this on a very basic level makes my skin crawl a little bit, but I'm not sure why. Why should we be worried that there's a patent on a mouse?
Well, I must admit, I use those examples partly because I think they do make people's skin crawl, because I want people to start thinking about this. And I confess openly before your audience that I think that we do need to be careful. We need to do more than just have our skin crawl. We need to think carefully about this. It may be necessary to extend patent law as far as it's currently being extended. It may be necessary for us to have patents over the human genome, for example, over living beings. Maybe. I haven't seen any empirical proof that it's necessary, and I think what we need is proof that without this, we're not going to get valuable drugs and valuable innovations and valuable medical procedures. I also think we need to think more carefully about the ethical implications down the line. I mean, this sounds like science fiction, but I'm informed by people who know a great deal about it that it, you know, is probably going to be reality within a relatively short period of time, certainly within our lifetimes. What about transgenic species? What about animals that are literally put together with some portion of the genome of one animal and some portion of the genome of another, something that's, say, half chimpanzee, half human? What about the person who produces that and says, well, here I have your perfect little worker, biddable, easy to control, agile, doesn't form unions, has no civil rights, won't be subject to whatever Congress raises the minimum wage to. The patent office says, well, we won't allow the patenting of human beings. Well, that's fine, but then that just pushes the inquiry back a step. What's a human being? I mean, we already have a mouse with a little bit of human genetic material in it. At what point are they going to draw the line and say, no, this is human, all too human? And at what point are they going to say, no, this is merely scientific development? So again, I think I think the skin crawling reaction is a sort of useful warning sign that we need to kind of slow down and think these things through.
James Boyle is my guest. He's a professor of law at American University. He's the author of Shaman, Software, and Spleens, Law and the Construction of the Information Society. We're talking about intellectual property rights in the information age, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Fresh Air. Back with James Boyle. His book about intellectual property rights is called Shamans, Software, and Spleens. It seems, at least in the in the administration's eyes, encoded in their proposal for intellectual property on the internet is the idea that the internet and electronic information warrants special treatment when it comes to copyrights or protection.
Mm-hmm.
Does it warrant special treatment? Why is it not a media just like any other media, just happens to come in a different form?
Well, I think their argument is that the internet makes copying easier, and indeed it does. Indeed, the internet is actually a system of transmission where to transmit something is to copy it, because the way that the internet breaks down messages to send them results in lots of unintended copies being generated all over the place. And so you could think of the internet as one giant copying machine, and I think that's the image that the government has. And their image is the only way that you're going to get, you know, great works of literature and music and video like The Lion King and Goosebumps online, is to basically up the level of copyright protection. They say they're not upping the level, but really they are, and I think most legal scholars would agree on that. To up the level of copyright protection, and to kind of, that's going to be the incentive that's going to lure, you know, Disney and RCA and a whole lot of other people onto the net. I think that they are only partially right. I do agree it will make copying easier. The internet makes copying easier. But it's always easy to see the kind of downsides of the new technology. It's always easy to figure out all the ways in which this is going to make it harder for someone who's just created some great work, a computer program or a movie or something, how it's going to make it harder for them to collect their return on their labor, which we need them to encourage them to produce the next movie. What's not so easy to see is the ways in which they're going to find new ways to charge and the ways in which these new technologies can actually help them. And a nice example is the history of the video recorder. When the VCR first appeared, the movie companies went absolutely crazy. They lobbied Congress. They went to the Supreme Court saying, you have to put a tax on VCRs. Unless you put a tax on VCRs, they'll destroy Hollywood. They generate all these copies. No one will ever go to the movies again. Hollywood will collapse. The only thing that we can make in America nowadays are software and movies. This will be the end of the American economy, and so on. And what actually happened, of course, is the Congress and the Supreme Court both turned them down, wisely it turned out. Video recorders dropped precipitously in price. Suddenly everyone had a video recorder, and video rentals saved Hollywood. And so what I think's happening is we've got an administration that thinks that can only see the downside of the internet for people who produce digital products, whether they're books or movies or software programs. What they can't see are all these new ways that people are going to find to make money off it. I mean, look at Netscape. It's the hottest stock on the stock exchange, and they give their software away. Well, I mean, you know, if someone's giving their software away, it's obviously that, you know, copying isn't their main problem. They're going to try and make their money in other ways. And I think that's what they need to focus more on, these other ways that people can make money off the net.
You cite that a quarter of all of the United States' exports rely on intellectual property rights. As more and more of our economy is tied up with this, do you see more and more pressure on either government and private industry to ensure that authorship and intellectual property rights remain very strict?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And indeed, that's what's happening right now. I mean, a large portion of the U.S. Trade Representative's job right now is to basically go around the world threatening people who pirate American intellectual property with the direst of consequences. All over the world now, what we've got is trade legislation like the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, the GATT, being used to monitor intellectual property rights. That's, you know, for example, if China doesn't respect our intellectual property rights, that's a violation of free trade because it's an implicit subsidy to Chinese industry. And so we put that right in the GATT, something that we don't do for even things like, say, child labor laws or environmental restrictions. You can violate those pretty much with impunity, at least under the GATT. But when it comes to IP rights, intellectual property rights, if you violate those, you're in trouble. So, yes, there's an enormous domestic pressure, and it has already yielded a lot of international movement in terms of protecting intellectual property rights. And some of that, of course, is necessary. I mean, I do agree intellectual property rights are necessary to encourage people to develop things and to give them a return. The question is whether or not the current level is actually way above the necessary level.
And the broader implications that you draw from this?
Well, I guess a couple. I think we haven't really adjusted to this new world yet. We're still talking in the sort of the paradigm of the manufacturing economy. When we think about the politics of the information economy, we don't really realize what's going on. I mean, if I said to you, they're going to sell off federal parkland to developers, you'd know exactly what your opinion was. Whether you were liberal or a conservative, you'd have a ready response, and you'd be pretty clear who'd be lined up for and against it. We don't have that kind of sort of easy political identification or analysis when it comes to the information age. If I say to you, fair use rights are being diminished, or you know, the intellectual property rights are being expanded in such and such a direction, it's hard for you to see the immediate implications on your kids' education, although there probably would be implications, or on the way in which your workplace is organized or whatever. So I think what we need is a little bit more of a movement that sees the connections among these issues, rather in the same way that the environmentalist movement developed. You know, in the 1950s, if you'd gone to a bird watcher or a mountain climber or a duck hunter and said to them, listen, you three have a tied interest in the environment, I think they would have thought you were crazy. You know, they would have said, no, he likes to shoot birds and I like to watch them. Nowadays, if you look at the environmentalist movement, everybody knows that those are some of the strongest supporters. And similarly, in this world, we need to understand what the coalition politics are. And if we have that and some basic intellectual tools, I have a lot of faith in the ability of the democratic process actually to control the excesses of this system. The question is whether we'll get the tools and whether we'll get the movement fast enough, or whether we'll build a sort of new set of sort of the robber barons of the information age before we really notice what's going on.
James Boyle, it was really enjoyable talking to you.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
James Boyle teaches law at American University. His new book is Shamans, Software, and Spleens. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how children learn to speak. We talk with linguist Naomi Barron about the pros and cons of baby talk and how parents and children collaborate on language acquisition. Also, a commentary from Gerald Early on the future of race, the new book by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Cornel West. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. How do children learn to talk? Anyone who spent time with young children knows that the answer is both mysterious and mundane. Children seem to magically soak up the language swirling around them and toss it back at you in endearingly unique and often cockeyed forms. My guest, linguist Naomi Barron, says that that apparent ease masks a complex series of neurological, physiological, and behavioral processes, which science is just beginning to uncover. Naomi Barron is a professor of linguistics at American University in Washington, D.C. She's the author of Growing Up with Language, How Children Learn to Talk. She says that the groundwork for language is laid down long before children utter their first word.
The groundwork is the universe around that child, the universe of sounds, of faces, of gestures, of everything that contains communicative intent. From the moment a child is born, there are people talking at it. And only gradually over time do they begin what we might call the conversational duet. Long before anyone is actually saying real words, before the child is saying real words, people are attempting to elicit a smile, a movement, and the child responds, often cooing or later babbling, and all of this input from the surrounding community later turns into words and eventually sentences and conversation.
Anyone who's spent some time around babies has caught them in these marathon monologues, babbling alone in their cribs or wherever. What's the function of babbling and that kind of private speech? What end does it serve?
As best we can tell, babbling is verbal play. It's trying out your articulator, seeing what happens when you put your tongue up against the roof of your mouth and force some air through it. If you listen to kids babble, and some of them do it by themselves and others love an audience, what you find them doing is exploring. And we listen and say, aha, this six-month-old said mama. No, the six-month-old just was playing with putting his or her lips together, opening up the back of the mouth so that the nasal sounds would resonate, and forcing some air out. It's only around age 12 months or so, a little bit before, a little bit after, depending on the child, that you start getting sounds that have meaning.
Let's shift gears a little bit and get right down to brass tacks.
Okay.
Why do most parents talk baby talk to their kids, and does it help kids learn to talk?
My hunch is that the major reason parents use baby talk, and we have to look at what baby talk means, is because it makes the parents feel good. It makes the parents feel good because if you're trying to talk with a 6 or an 8 or 10-month-old or even a 2-year-old, there's very little conversation coming back to you. So you're looking for some way to get connected. In many cases, you have no idea what your child is saying. Your child is looking at you and plaintively saying, duh. Okay, is that dog? Is that daddy? Is that duck? Is that done? You don't know. They all come out as duh. So if you have some way to feel, I'm connected. I'm saying the same sorts of things that my child is. My child's using a much higher pitch speech than I am, I could do that now. My child is saying very little, I could simplify my sentences. My child is saying some things that are ungrammatical. A child might say, more up. And a parent could say in return, yes, I'll give you more up, meaning I'll pick you up again. There's a feeling of connectedness that just doesn't come so easily when you're dealing with someone who doesn't quite look human in many ways yet. Now, does it help? Well, it depends on what aspects of baby talk we're talking about. Baby talk is really a collection of possibilities. And in different cultures, one or another of those items is used. And they're not all used the same in all societies. For example, in much of the world, we use a higher pitch in talking with little children than we do with older people. There are some parts of the world, for example, in Guatemala, where it seems you use lower pitch, because lower pitch is what you use for people of lower status. High pitch is what you use for adults of higher status. So there are other extenuating factors. On the other hand, being ungrammatical because your child is certainly not going to help the language development. But when your child is at the point of knowing how to say it right, that you don't say more up, either you will stop or your child will say, Mommy, no.
So what about parents who don't do it? And it seems that more and more people aren't. And I was thinking perhaps as people have children later in life, mm-hmm. They have all sorts of ideas about what's dignified or what's right to do or what's not.
It's interesting. Particular people 30 or 35 and up who are having first children and who are well-educated say, I'll never sound like that in talking with my child. But if you listen to them, you'll find they tend to do a couple of things. First, they tend to slow down their speech. Second, they do tend to use higher intonation patterns. Third, they tend to repeat themselves. A typical characteristic of baby talk is saying the same thing more than once. Why do you do that? Well, how much conversation can you have with a child who's saying either nothing or very little back to you? So repeating yourself to fill the airspace is not such a strange thing. The differences that we're starting to see among older first-time parents, well-educated first-time parents, is they will often introduce new words that were never part of baby talk because they're too sophisticated. I saw a mother the other day at a Starbucks who was explaining to her 2-year-old in a nice, slow baby talk register which coffee was decaffeinated, which coffee and what color the top was, which coffee was French brew. And this kid was just looking, but she was using a teaching register, but with much more sophisticated language. She looked around 40.
Every parent has the requisite Dr. Seuss books or Ogden Nash rhymes or whatever nursery rhymes, nonsense language books and nonsense language play that you engage in with your children. I know it's wonderful, but I don't know why. Why do children respond so well to it? Why does it stick in our brains so securely and so vividly from our own childhood?
Rhymes are always easier to remember because you have a hook to hang something on. The oral epic poets knew this a long time ago. You can remember things if you have a pattern on which to hook things. And children are no different because you're halfway there. All you have to learn is the beginning sound in the word to get 2 words for the price of one. We know that most children absolutely adore rhymes. The good news is those rhyming abilities can translate into language development. Some very interesting studies have been done at the State University of New York at Stony Brook showing that children who know nursery rhymes, Hickory Dickory Dock and so forth, turn out to become earlier readers than people who didn't grow up on these rhymes. Now, why is that? Because what do you do when you read? You have to look at a word and break it into pieces. You know, if you don't believe in the whole word method of reading, but one that breaks things into sounds, a so-called phonic approach, then if you've already learned cat and mat and rat and sat have something to do with each other, then when you see cat and mat written, you're halfway there because you already know the at part is the same in both the words.
So they have a head start.
Absolutely, they have a head start.
My guest is Naomi Barron. She's a professor of linguistics at the American University in Washington, D.C. She's written a number of books about language and language acquisition. Her most recent book is called Growing Up with Language, How Children Learn to Talk. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with linguist Naomi Barron. Her book about how children learn to talk is called Growing Up with Language. Well, let's talk about some myths. I'd like you to debunk.
Okay. I'll try.
It seems as if the way you're describing language acquisition, it's as if children learn language by talking themselves into it with the help of parents and the incentive of a social culture. But then you hear stories from mothers and fathers. For instance, my child didn't say a word, not a single word, till he was four, and then he spoke in full sentences. How do you explain either these wide variations among among kids, or do parents have selective memories?
The parents are probably right, but there are a number of other factors we have to look at. The first is, if the child is developing normally but doesn't happen to be saying a lot, there could be many reasons for it. First, you want to make sure there's no hearing problem. But if indeed this child, let's say at age 3, suddenly starts putting a bunch of words together, whether it's a full sentence or not, we could look at, and hasn't used a lot of individual words before then, this may be a child who's shy. There are a lot of very shy children who understand a lot of language. How do you know this? You go through a picture dictionary, and you find out when you say, show me the so-and-so, show me the so-and-so. You go through sets of pictures. The dog is kissing the cat. Another one, the cat is kissing the dog, and you ask which is which, and they can understand. There may be many reasons why children are not just prolific talkers, some of which may be related to such things as prematurity. We know that children who were born premature but otherwise healthy tend to be a little slower in all aspects of development, including the development of their articulators. Just the physiology hasn't caught up with that of normal kids yet. So if speaking is a real strain, it doesn't necessarily mean that understanding is. At some point, that practice, that praxis, seems to be critical, but it doesn't have the same role for everybody.
There's an old joke about Albert Einstein, that he didn't talk until he was 4, and then one day his mother served him some soup, and he said, "Mother, this soup is too hot." And his mother says, Albert, why did you never talk before? And he says, "That is because up until now everything had been quite adequate." And I think that's myth two, that myth number two, that some children speak late just because they don't want or need to talk.
It's an interesting story. Actually, Albert Einstein himself, in his diaries and letters, doesn't say it quite the same way. There's a letter which I believe he wrote to his sister talking about his own memories of his early language. And he doesn't talk about soup, but he does say he remembers his parents being very concerned about the fact he didn't seem to be talking. And he doesn't remember exactly what age this is, but it seemed to be somewhere around 4 or 5. Now, he also says he felt he was exceedingly fortunate in not codifying the world linguistically, at least in terms of speaking, because he says, I was able to experience things without some set of categories I had to stick things into. Whether this is reading things into his own experiences after the fact, we don't know. Now, we do know that if you don't give children an opportunity to speak, chances are they're going to be slower to develop linguistically. When you look at families where there are 2 or more children of roughly the same age, say a 1-year-old and a 4-year-old or a 2-year-old and a 6-year-old, often it's the older child who steals the floor. And as a result, the younger kids don't have much time to talk, or if they start a sentence, someone else often finishes it for them. And we also know that second-born children, assuming you've got a sibling who's not 10 or 15 years older, tend to be slower in grammatical development, and in fact slower in acquisition of first words than children who were firstborn or only children.
Here's another myth then that you can consider for us. A lot of parents will say, my child walked early and he really, really was interested in running and learning to play with balls and walking upstairs, and he didn't really talk. I don't think he had the brain power to focus on both activities at one time.
His brain is fine. His interest may be non-existent. In the early, say in the first 2 to 3 years of life, there's some families and some cultures that really emphasize verbal communication. There are other cultures that essentially ignore young children. They leave the raising of young children to aunts or to older siblings, and they don't really address a lot of language to kids and don't take children as these things you have to nurture very early on. You have to take care of them, but not really actively nurture them. So you will find some differences across societies, for example, as to when children tend to use their first word. It does differ depending upon, as best we can tell, how much language you address to the child. There also probably are some differences between males and females. And I won't stereotype things and say boys all do this and girls all do this, but on average, boys tend to start talking in the sense of first words and then of putting two words together, a little bit later than girls. Girls, on average, are starting to put two words together sometime around 18 months. Boys, on average, and I'm talking about American society, closer to about 22 months. Is that because physiologically their articulators are not as developed? That's one possibility. Is that because they're more active and more interested in roaming around? That's another possibility. We don't have a really good answer.
Do you think we talk to boys differently than we talk to girls?
Unfortunately, yes. There's a lot of data now available indicating that, at least in the American society, we talk less to boys as infants than we do to girls. And then as boys start growing, we tend to talk differently with them. Why does this happen? Well, in the early stages, my hunch is we talk less to male infants because they are verbalizing less to us. And our feelings as parents can be hurt just as much as they can as adults in, you know, the adult world. And if you're not talking with me, why should I be talking back with you? We know, for example, that parents of premature children tend not to verbalize to them, you know, when they're in their infant months, because they're not verbalizing back. Interestingly, in some cultures, things flip the other way. There's a wonderful study done in Greece, in orphanages, looking at the rate of development of language in male children and female children in their infancy and toddlerhood. And it turned out the boys were developing faster than the girls. Well, it also turned out that because of the cultural stereotype of males being important and females being less so, the caretakers were addressing incredibly more language to the male infants than they were to the female infants.
You mentioned earlier articulators, mm-hmm. and I assume that means the mouth's ability to articulate different mm-hmm. sounds. What mm-hmm. makes some sounds hard to pronounce? And why do so many kids say paschetti for spaghetti, as if they had these universal, easier ways to pronounce some words that they all pick up in baby school?
There are really two answers to the question. One has to do with where, how you actually form the individual sounds. You take a sound like p or b. It's pretty clear how you form that sound. You put your lips together, and then you open them up with a breath of air. On the other hand, think about how you make an L, ul. Your tongue is sitting there in Netherland, and it's very hard, because you can't see, if you're a child, what that is looking like. It's hard to know how do you actually form an L or an R, or how do you do things like ch, which takes an awful lot of control over your tongue and just when you release it and how much oomph and air or fricative sound, as we would call it, is going to come out. So that's one problem. Some sounds are just physically easier to see someone else make. The second thing is, if you take a word like spaghetti and you look at how you combine together the sounds, it's a hard word to make, because what you've got to do is flip your tongue back and forth. You start with a s. Okay, that's sort of around where your teeth are, a little bit farther back. Then you've got to move to a p. Then you've got to go all the way in the back of the mouth to where a g is. And then you've got to go back to the middle of the mouth again for a t. And some of these sounds have your vocal cords vibrating. We call them voiced sounds, and some don't. And if you try to do all that together, it's hard. On the other hand, p, that's easy. Sk, you're moving your way back in the mouth. So we have p, sk, t. All kept in the front of the mouth, because you move that k forward a little bit because there's an s sitting there, and we tend to have languages assimilate or come closer together in place of articulation. So it was much easier to produce. And none of that has your vocal cords vibrating for the consonant sounds.
Do you see children's language development and facility changing in any way as our society changes? And I'm thinking that more and more kids are spending more time in daycare centers rather mm-hmm. than alone at home with their mother patiently baby talking to them. Has that had any measurable impact on language development?
Well, it's interesting to compare daycare centers with kids raised at home, because we all assume if you're at home with a parent or a full-time caregiver, of course you're going to hear more language. Some studies have been done comparing those kinds of families where the kids are at home with their generally mothers, with like socioeconomic grouped children who were in daycare centers. And it turned out that the amount of language directed to the children, both at the daycare centers, but particularly after those kids got home at night, was much greater than the kids who were home all day with their mother or father or caretaker was getting. In part, this may be late 20th century guilt that we haven't seen our kids all day and we just have to talk with them a lot at night. In part, it may be a kind of belief that kids just sort of grow by themselves and they've always for generations been at home and there's nothing special we have to do for them. In part, I strongly suspect, where you have caregivers who are not native speakers of the language of the community, and this is happening increasingly in the United States, the caregiver doesn't talk much. Here was this wonderful opportunity to learn a second language, and very, very little conversation goes on. I go to playgrounds in my neighborhood in Upper Northwest Washington, and you see all these people from very affluent families, children out with their full-time caregiver, and the caregivers are not talking with the children. There is total silence on the playground.
And here parents are thinking their child is getting, I don't know, a special education because or special attention because they're
Indeed.
Home.
Indeed. But you have to plan. You have to think about it. You have to tell your caregiver what you're looking for and to make it happen.
I really enjoyed talking with you today. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Naomi Barron's latest book is called Growing Up with Language. Barron is a professor of linguistics at American University. This is Fresh Air. A new book by two prominent African-American intellectuals examines what it means to be an educated black leader today. The book is called The Future of the Race, and it's co-authored by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Cornel West. Writer and critic Gerald Early says that the growing influence of an expanding black middle class has made it possible to publish a book like this today.
With the extraordinary rise of the black middle class over the last 25 years, has come the rise not only in the number of black intellectuals, but in their public profile. We've seen the emergence of a true black elite, a professionalized black intellectual class. This was W.E.B. Du Bois's vision at the turn of the century when he spoke of the establishment of a talented tenth, a leadership group of intellectual, professional, middle-class blacks who would lead the race. As Du Bois wrote in 1903, "It need hardly be argued that the Negro people need social leadership more than most groups, that they have no traditions to fall back upon, no long-established customs, no strong family ties, no well-defined social classes." While many people today might strenuously debate Du Bois's characterizations of African Americans, most would agree that the group still needs strong leadership to combat its subordinate status. This leads me to a new book entitled The Future of the Race by Henry Louis Gates Jr. and Cornel West, both well-known professors at Harvard University. If there is a black talented tenth today, both of these men are surely among its most important and brilliant members. It certainly wouldn't have been possible even 10 years ago for black scholars to claim the mantle of Du Bois and to find anyone in the American intelligentsia who would have cared. It is a testament to both the vibrancy of the black elite and the incandescence of Gates and West that the ritual of taking up Du Bois's mantle has become a major cultural act. But the book is also a symptom of the growing uneasiness and tension of that class. As the black professional class grows and it becomes more and more removed from working class and poor blacks, bourgeois blacks feel greater guilt and greater impotency, and as a result, greater rage. Why have the social efforts that have rescued some not rescued all? Why are those blacks who have money and fame unable to help more effectively those with nothing? Why does the black community seem to lack cohesion across class lines? Was it simply a common and bitter oppression that held us black folk together? And has this black elite done as much with its chances as it could or should? West and Gates have written essays that are responses to Du Bois's essays on the construction of a talented tenth. Gates writes about his days as an undergraduate at Yale, while West analyzes Du Bois as a social and philosophical thinker. What is striking about this book is not how the authors address Du Bois or any particular set of social or public policy issues, but how both men express the ambivalence of a robust but harried and unsure black elite. The very quality of the essays, hurried and superficial, reveal much about the price of celebrity status and popular success for these two men that has come at the expense, in this instance, of scholarly and intellectual rigor. In some ways, the essays almost function as apologies, as statements where both men wish to announce their solidarity with black folk, that they are true to the cause of black liberation. Perhaps the sheer self-consciousness of the elite has become something of a burden and a pose. What is the meaning of black success? We Americans have yet fully to understand that question.
Gerald Early directs the Department of African and Afro-American Studies at Washington University. Audrey Bentham is Fresh Air's technical director. Our engineers this week are Al Banks, Chris Fraley, and Joyce Lieberman. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.